I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The latest recovery plan from the Biden administration has a projected cost of $2 trillion and plans for everything from roads and bridges to internet access and housing. Today, how Congress is viewing this massive attempt to get the country not just back on its feet, but a step or two ahead of where it was before the pandemic. U.S. Representative Emanuel Cleaver shares his thoughts, and we'll take a closer look at what the $2 trillion will get you. Then, our local newspapers have been closing at a horrific rate. One Kansas City publisher brought home what it would mean to his readers if their local news source dried up. We'll ask what the community response has been. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. President Joe Biden is taking aim at a massive infrastructure package that deals with what most of us think of when we hear the word infrastructure. I'm talking roads and bridges. But it also covers infrastructure in another sense, and that's human capital. We're going to visit now with a member of Congress from our area about this ambitious proposal and a journalist who covers these issues. We'll begin with Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, who's a Democrat from Kansas City. The congressman is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Housing, Community Development, and Insurance. Congressman, it's always good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Hey, how did you feel about this, the president's infrastructure plan as it stands now, Congressman?
I'm going to support it. I think that overall it is one of the best things that that our nation has attempted to do since the Franklin Roosevelt years with the New Deal. This will far exceed the New Deal. It will far exceed the Great Society of LBJ. I think this is not only historic in the sense of measuring money being spent, but it's historic in the ambition of this president, who I think realizes that if America is going to retain, or maybe in some instances regain, its position as the leader of the world, we have got to take care of home, and we have not done that. If you just look at the American Society of Civil Engineers, they give our infrastructure right now a D+. I was fortunate to be selected to serve about 4 years ago on beginning to serve on the Helsinki Commission. So I've had the opportunity to travel all around the world. And the people around the world, in many instances, still believe that America's highways are as they were in the 1960s, in the 1970s, and they're not. We are not the leader of infrastructure. And so this is absolutely critically important to the American public. And the unique thing, Steve, I think I should mention is that, and it began on our committee, we've redefined infrastructure. At least part of the new definition entails housing. As somebody who lived in a shack for 7 years and lived in public housing after that, I can tell you that that housing is probably the most critical thing for people. And all you have to do is go to prison and look at the people who have been in who are in prison, and look at the number of individuals in there who are homeowners.
Right.
That's always has been historically where just showing you the value of housing. And
you know,
so we're going to also make broadband a part of of infrastructure. That's urban broadband and rural. I represent a huge rural area. And it saddens me to see young high school students go to McDonald's after class to do their homework because that's the only place they can connect with Wi-Fi. They don't have it in their homes. So that's a part of the infrastructure, and I'm excited about that. We're going to build, preserve, and retrofit 2 million homes and commercial buildings to deal with this housing crisis.
You know, Republicans, Congressman, let me just interrupt. Republicans are criticizing the package just on the point you're making, that there's not enough dollars being set aside here for what we traditionally think of as infrastructure, roads and bridges. In fact, we have a statement from 4th District Representative, your colleague from Missouri, Vicki Hartzler, who represents a district just south and east of Kansas City. And she writes this: "While we can all agree that America's roads and bridges are in a desperate state of repair, President Biden's infrastructure proposal barely addresses this need, allocating only 5% of the overall package to our nation's streets." What about that part of it?
Well, the 5% is probably close to being accurate, but that 5% would allow us to deal with about 45,000 bridges. And if we deal with the bridges, it allows us to address a lot of the delays caused by, you know, traffic congestion. And I it is estimated by some that's $160 billion per year when motorists are forced to pay. And right here in Kansas City is the obvious, about $1,000 each year on wasted time and wasted fuel. Now, that's no reason to vote against it. Vicki Hartzler and I get along quite well, so this is not a personal attack. Mm-hmm. But the majority of the people in this country support this plan. The latest polling says 71% of the American public and the majority of Republicans support it. I think in Congress we're going to have some people in leadership who are just going to say that we got to vote no, we can't give this president this kind of a victory, because it means that he will be almost invincible at voting time, and that's unfortunate that we've gotten to this point in our politics. But all of the people who are going to criticize this, Steve, I can guarantee you, just as sure as God sits on the throne and that the sun shines during the daylight and the moon comes out at night, they are going to be out claiming credit for all of the infrastructure projects that they consider infrastructure.
You know, on the flip side of the coin, there are members of your own party who are saying this $2 trillion package isn't big enough. Do you agree with that?
No. And I know the people personally who are saying that. I serve on the committee with some of them. And I guess I should say that this is a very, very small minority of our members who are saying we need to go to $10 trillion. $10 trillion is not going to pass. I hope it's not even discussed, because people will exploit it to try to show that, you know, that this is the camel's nose in the tent and so forth. I don't support this $10 trillion package. I think this is ambitious, what we have before us. I think we do we do more than anything that has ever been done by the government. It begins to, you see, there are a lot of people who don't want the government to succeed. Their goal, they run for public office to become a part of the government to try to dismantle the government. And so they don't want it to succeed. I do. I want it to succeed for myself, for my children, mm-hmm. And for their children. And that means that we have got to break out of this this bitter and poisonous partisanship and connect ourselves with what we know to be good. There are going to be always things in a package like this that are distasteful to some, but it doesn't mean that this package should go down, and it's not going to go down. Frankly, the American public supports it. They realize that we have 55 major corporations that did not pay one single penny in taxes last year. That's not right, and so we're going to have to raise the corporate tax rate. There's some discussion that's going on at the White House now about whether or not we should go to 28 or to 25.
Right. Hey, just one final point, Congressman, before I lose you here. Is this package going to need 60 votes in the Senate to pass? Because there's some news in the last couple of days from the Senate parliamentarian who is suggesting that may not be the case.
Well, yeah, we don't know yet. All I know is that the president is meeting with Republican and Democratic senators at the White House this week, and we'll probably continue it next week in order to try to convince them that we need to pass this, and the Senate doesn't need to go to use these arcane techniques to stop progressive legislation. That's what has been done historically. You know, if necessary, I think we'll have to go and do things that are not what most of us would like to do. We'd like to have a bipartisan piece of legislation. Right. It probably is not going to happen. But I think the president is trying, very desperately trying.
We'll leave our conversation there. That's Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, a Democrat from Kansas City. Congressman, always appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
I want to now bring in Jordan Weissman. He's an economics and public policy reporter for Slate to talk to us about some of the finer details of this infrastructure package. And I should note that I believe that today's your birthday, Jordan. So happy birthday.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Word spreads quickly across the country when it's your birthday.
It does. Twitter helps. Twitter helps.
So, Jordan, provide some context when it comes to what this bill really is. When we think of infrastructure, roads are probably the first thing to come to most people's minds. What does this bill do for our streets and highways? Let's start with that.
Well, it does provide a lot of money for them, without question. You know, the Republicans, such as Senate Minority Leader, I should say, Mitch McConnell, have emphasize that it only spends about 5 to 6% of the funding on roads and bridges, which is true, but it's also a very large bill. It's 5%. It's 5 to 6% of a very, very large chunk of change. And so, yes, there would be money to repair the streets and highways and the 10 most economically important bridges in need of repair, which apparently someone in the Department of Transportation knows exactly what those bridges are, and they will eventually be revealed. But you know, I think this debate over how much of this bill is, quote, infrastructure and how much of it is other stuff, right, is it's a little bit silly, right? Let's be real. Like, there's, you know, you can do a sort of Talmudic, or very academic, debate about the exact meaning of infrastructure. But I personally like to think of this, and that's sort of how the bill's been pitched, right? I mean, Joe Biden has emphasized the aspect of fixing roads and bridges, the long-deferred repairs. But I think of it as something much broader, which is this is sort of an economic modernization bill, right? It's meant to fix our kind of decayed and aging infrastructure while adding new things adding new things that we're going to need for the future, such as, you know, a network of electric car chargers all around the country. Mm-hmm. It's going to create the infrastructure necessary for a transition to a carbon-free economy, to green energy, by upgrading the electric grid, for instance. And, you know, I think we've all seen how badly our electric infrastructure could probably use some fixes after the disaster in Texas. And then there are, you know, other slightly, even less directly related to infrastructure things that are nonetheless very important if you think about the future of the economy. There's a large section about funding advanced scientific research and R&D. That's a huge pillar of this bill. Is that infrastructure spending? Is creating a scientific directorate to look into, climate tech and AI, which is one of the interesting things in this bill. Is that
artificial intelligence you're talking about? Yeah.
Artificial intelligence. I would not argue that's infrastructure. I don't think that I don't know a definition of the word that it really fits with. Is it important to the future of the economy? I would say so. I think a lot of people would say so. And so that's why. And then there's this last very large aspect of it. This $400 billion that would go to elder care and care for the disabled at home, right? And that's been a lot of people, and the administration has tried to say, well, that's human infrastructure, it's care infrastructure. Really, it's just something that's going to be necessary as America ages. I think that's more the issue there. And that's going to be a necessary part of our economy, is how do we take care of our aging and disabled relatives as we become older?
So you're saying that the sweeping nature of this package is breathtaking. You also say there's a bit of what you call economic nationalism taking place here. What is that about?
Right. And, you know, I think it helps to kind of close your eyes and go back a year or so to the bygone days of Donald Trump, right? Where he had a very specific version of economic nationalism in his head that he liked to call America First, which was it was very aggressive and jingoistic. It was about tariffs, right? And, you know, stopping imported goods from coming in and kind of trying to boss around your allies on the global stage whenever you could, and saying America will go it alone if necessary. This sort of flips that. Instead of saying we're going to put up a lot of tariffs and we're going to be very aggressive and try to, you know, wave around a big stick in international forums, we're just going to fund the industries of the future here. We're going to provide the U.S. is going to try to build something like an electric battery industry, which many people have always wanted here in the U.S., right? To build electric batteries for electric cars, or to build batteries for electric cars. That's something that a lot of people think is a weak point in American industry, that we can't build those ourselves. We have to rely on China. Right. So why don't we provide the funding necessary to actually cultivate that sort of an industry here? And this is a bill that would do that sort of thing. It would say, okay, we're going to try to bring some of these advanced industries home and cultivate them with the hand of government, rather than just trying to keep foreign goods out of the country. That's what I say when there's some economic nationalism. That's what's going on.
We're talking about President Joe Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure package. My guest is Jordan Weissman. He's a policy reporter with Slate Magazine. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So at the end of the day, how do you believe this package will wind up impacting jobs and maybe the future of the U.S. economy if this thing does indeed pass?
I think it would be very significant. I think it would absolutely create jobs. when you pour a lot of money into the economy, it tends to do that, and it would certainly try to cultivate jobs in certain kinds of industries. It would be good for construction workers and people in green industries, and also would be a huge helping hand to care workers. The idea is to sort of not only provide more affordable home health care, it's to make sure that the people who, the home health aides who do that work are paid well. Right now those wages are very low. But as far as the future of the economy goes, I think it would be very significant. And, I think a big part of it is that this is, it's an infrastructure bill, but it also is a climate bill and a decarbonization bill. It is, part of the political strategy here. And I think part of the reason you see Republicans pushing back and saying it's not really infrastructure is that Biden is trying to bring together infrastructure legislation. And that's sort of an idea that's just generally popular with voters, and combine it with, climate policy and green energy policy, and which is a little bit more controversial. And he's saying, well, the future of the economy is going to be low carbon. It has to be low carbon. Mm-hmm. And so it's making the necessary investments we need now in order to move in that direction.
Jordan, what's the thinking out in Washington? Is the expectation now that this thing is going to become law, that it will pass Congress in roughly the same form that it's in now, based on what we're hearing from the Senate parliamentarian? Or even if that ruling doesn't hold up, if the Senate will go ahead and pass it even without the 60 votes that are required?
I think that it's a question mark, what this bill will look like in the end. I'm personally, the other day I had a chat for Slate where I said I'm personally optimistic, and that's because I'm an optimist. but I think, no one is quite sure exactly what it's going to look like. There's going to be a lot of horse trading in Congress. Joe Manchin, the all-important senator from West Virginia, has already said that he's unhappy with some of the corporate tax provisions and would like to see those changed. And so you could see the funding shifted. I mean, each part of this bill is a little bit is going to attract some amount of controversy, and there's going to be a lot of haggling. So will it look something like this in its final form? It could. And I think there's a good chance that, you will see something of this magnitude. But will the specifics come out exactly the way the Biden administration has proposed, sort of the way Congress almost passed the exact plan that he offered up with the American Rescue Plan? Mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll see a repeat of that. I think that there, Congress is going to try to leave its thumbprint on this, or its fingerprints on this, certainly.
A lot of people are painting this legislation as something comparable to FDR-style governing. You just heard Congressman Cleaver refer to FDR and describing this package as even more ambitious than anything involved in the New Deal back in the 1930s. Do you agree with that?
Oh, that's a loaded question. So, I mean, it depends on what part of the New Deal you're talking about. I mean, this would be I think this would be a historic piece of legislation, in part because of the way it would try to really, really push forward the transition to a zero carbon economy, right? Or away from carbon at least. And that could be part of a major lasting legacy. It would also just do some very good things for the country, like get rid of lead pipes in the water systems and make sure everybody has broadband. Those would be really lasting legacy achievements that would be historic in their own way and would modernize large parts of the country. And in some ways, it is comparable to the New Deal, which in many ways was, about building an economic modernization. FDR brought electricity to rural America, right? Like that's sort of, people forget in the 1930s, large swaths of America just did not have electricity. Like, if you lived on a farm, it was a good chance that everything was you had a horse-drawn plow. It was just, it was a pre-modern world in a lot of ways. But at the same time, the New Deal really laid the foundations of American government as we know it today. It created a lot of the modern welfare state. It created a lot of the modern infrastructure that we take for granted. Programs like unemployment insurance and Social Security and modern labor law. It's hard to compare anything really to the New Deal in terms of magnitude. Likewise, I heard the congressman mention Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. That gave us Medicare and Medicaid, right? I mean, it massively expanded Social Security and decreased elder poverty in significant ways. So, would this bill on its own have the same magnitude as one of those? No, but it is part of an extremely, if you think of it as part of Biden's larger agenda, right? Like including some of the things that were included in the coronavirus bill that could eventually become permanent, like child benefits that are going to massively cut child poverty. And you think about this as sort of the decarbonizing and economic modernization part of his agenda. He is trying to pull together a historic string of accomplishments that would, if they did all pass, I think could fit him in that list of great Democratic presidents. But again, we've yet to see how this bill will shape up once it goes through the meat grinder that is Capitol Hill.
Again, we're talking about President Joe Biden's infrastructure package totaling about $2 million. Whether it's going to change, is it going to pass the way it in the shape that it's in right now? Jordan Weisman is my guest. He's a policy reporter for Slate. Is this, to reference another former president, you've called this bill something of a rejection of Reaganism. And it is amazing how the country has swung in 40 years from the conservatism of Ronald Reagan to something akin to what Joe Biden is doing now with trillions of dollars of new projects being passed. Explain what you mean when you talk about this bill being a rejection of Reaganism.
Well, I think it is on multiple levels, and we can get really deep in the weeds if you want to about the economic theory underpinning it. But on just a very like, but let's on just on a very basic level, right? If you think about Reaganism as the idea that government is the problem, and that the solution is and government spending is the problem supposedly, and the solution is to lower tax rates to encourage private investment and private capital and the job creators to get out there and do their magic and deregulate, and that was how we were going to fix the economy. If you think of that as sort of the soul of Reaganism and supply side economics, this is very obviously the opposite, right? This is all about how the hand of government can push the country forward and kind of bring the economy into the 21st century, and how government spending and and government industrial policy aimed at cultivating new and advanced industries, how all of that can kind of make the country better and set us on a path towards the future. And you can go further into it. This is a bill that's pretty union friendly, and of course Ronald Reagan was known as not being so union friendly. He's famous for crushing the crushing the airport air traffic controllers union. And they're also so I mean just when you're talking about it in that way, it's sort of a reversal. And also I think if you think about the problems that existed in 1979 and 1980 when Reaganism was ascendant, and or 81 you could say, but and the problems that exist now in the economy, it makes sense that there would be this sort of a change, right? In 1980, the big problem was inflation, right? And there was this idea that the government was spending too much, and that we sort of had this malaise, and that you couldn't there wasn't some, that the problem couldn't be fixed with another budget bill. And you can debate how accurate that diagnosis was, but that was the sense of things at the time, right? You know, there was times like, well, we need more private investment. There's a lack of capital.
Right.
That was the mood of the country then. That's not the mood now. That's not the problem anyway. Now the idea is like, actually, the world is awash in money that rich people have. Rich people are saving too much.
Right.
There's too much capital. You see these crazy investment people are investing in crazy things like NFTs and see the prices of cryptocurrency skyrocketing,
right.
Baseball cards.
Right.
There's too much money floating around. Instead, you need it to be directed somewhere to necessary investments that are going to kind of build up the foundations of the economy. And so that is, I think, now we're getting a little bit into the weeds of theory, but times have changed, and the economic and the solutions to our problems have, I think, as a result changed. This bill is responsive to that.
Jordan, is this thing going to pass with any Republican support, or is it going to be strictly along party lines?
I think everyone expects it to sort of be a party line vote at this point.
Wow.
Mitch McConnell is talking about fighting Biden every step of the way. By now, the idea that there's going to be a big bipartisan agreement, it seems a little far-fetched, and there's a good reason for that, which is, yes, this is an infrastructure bill, and it does, Republicans are being honest about their complaints to some extent. They're saying, it doesn't spend enough money on traditional infrastructure as they, define it, which means roads and bridges. It does, and it spends a lot of money on things like, green energy,
right,
which is extremely important to, not just Democrats, but to many Americans. People say that this bill's been described as a $2 trillion bill. If you add in the green energy tax credits that they're talking about, it goes all the way up to about $2.6 trillion.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
It isn't just about roads and bridges. It is about, it is about some of these other kind of more democratic priorities that aren't going to be, they are not going to drop from the bill. And it's very hard to imagine Republicans getting on board with them because they are a little bit more skeptical about the need to spend to deal with things like climate change. I don't expect a big bipartisan breakthrough here.
Well, that's Jordan Weisman. He's economics and public policy reporter for Slate, talking about Joe Biden's big infrastructure package. Jordan, appreciate the insights, appreciate the good commentary here, and hopefully we'll talk again before long.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And happy birthday again. You bet.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about local newspapers and why so many of them are closing across the country and what's being lost. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Since 2004, 1,800 newspapers have closed in the United States. That's about 100 a year. Funny thing, though, when those papers go away, lots of people miss them and wish they hadn't disappeared. Now, let's talk about the importance of keeping these papers around with two people who know what's at stake if we lose them. With us, Michael Bushnell is publisher of the Northeast News. That's a newspaper that's been covering historic Northeast Kansas City for nearly 90 years. 2 weeks ago, the paper published a blank front page to send a warning sign to the community about what might come about if it ceased to exist. Michael, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you very much for having me.
Justin Wingerder is a reporter for the Denver Post and a former reporter for the Topeka Capital Journal. On Tuesday, he wrote an op-ed in the Kansas Reflector saying that local reporting from small-town Kansas newspapers was crucial in his writing of a new book, Four Shots in Oski, Murder and Innocence in Middle America, about the unbelievable story of Floyd Bledsoe in Oskaloosa, Kansas. Justin, it's nice to have you, too. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks.
Michael, what was the thinking behind that blank front page, and what did you want to accomplish there?
I tell you what, we wanted to send a message. We had lost three key advertisers at the end of 2020, and that really put us into dire straits as far as the financial condition of the paper. We did not qualify for whatever reason for PPP funding on round two. So we were spitballing in a staff meeting and somebody came up with it and said, what if we just did nothing? What if we published nothing on the front page to send that message of what it looks like when there's no community newspaper to cover news in the community? And it just kind of blossomed from there. And in addition to that, we went on what we call radio silence from midnight Tuesday to midnight Wednesday. So we didn't publish any new content during that same time period, did not return any phone calls, because we wanted to send a very strong message that community newspapers are vital to the communities that they serve. And I think at this stage of the game, we can all agree that, you know, that it resonated.
I was going to say, Michael, that was a gutsy move. How did people in the Northeast neighborhoods respond to it?
We had, at first, the reactions were predictable. People calling the paper and saying, or calling me on my cell phone and saying, hey, your printer really messed up. You don't have any words on your front page underneath your banner. And, you know, of course, that's quite a start when you get the paper, you know, thrown at the door of the business. There's something wrong. I need to call them.
Right.
And then once you opened that up and read the pieces inside, which were the only things we ran that week, were dedicated to community journalism, its importance, and what a community would look like without a paper, and the Walmart of community journalism across the country. And once people read those, we had businesses step up. We had a couple of nonprofits actually step up and say, hey, what can we do to help? What do you need from us? And these were present advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
They said, what can, you know, we're willing to do a little bit more in order to support you because you're the glue that holds the community together.
Wow.
So it's very, very positive feedback.
Justin, what did you make of the blank front page of the Northeast News? How did it strike you?
I thought it was really brave and really cool. And I'm thrilled to hear that it had that sort of response. I did not know that what happened after it was published. And that is so cool to hear.
How dire, Justin, are things for local newspapers across the country? What have you picked up?
That statistic you began with, 1,800 newspapers right. in less than 20 years. It's a statistic I cite in my op-ed in the Reflector. It's a staggering, staggering statistic. An industry go through a slow motion free fall, and our country is worse off for it.
What do you lose when you lose a local newspaper, Justin?
Well, research shows that newspaper closures lead to higher taxes, lower voter participation rates, and less informed public. That's sort of the academic answer. I'd put it more blunt, it's a great time to be a small town crook or an incompetent public official. I mean, when the watchdogs are laid off, when there's no one covering the town council or looking at the city finances, that makes it easier to misuse, abuse, or even steal taxpayer dollars. You know, the I like to use is, imagine if the federal government decided that over the course of 20 years, it was going to eliminate all of the auditors and inspector general. People would be outraged because common sense tells you, watching, that's when corruption is more likely to occur, or just questionable spending. And that's what we're seeing with small town newspapers and community newspapers, is slow motion, 20-year long removal of the auditors, the watchdogs,
wow.
an eye on their local government. And when they go away, I think bad things happen.
What was the one line in the column? I think it got a lot of national attention, Justin, that don't be surprised if a Costco goes up down at the end of the block and no one in a family knew anything about it. And the kids are saying, hey, what is that building? And mom and dad have no idea. And here comes a Costco just a block away.
Yeah, in that case, the Costco may be perfectly legal, perfect, can be good for the community. But suddenly something happens and you don't know what's going on because your local paper wasn't there to cover it.
Right.
A Costco coming up is not big enough news for the, you know, the city that's maybe 45 minutes or an hour away that has a big newspaper. It's not going to be big enough news. So they didn't write about it. You didn't hear about it on the local news. You didn't hear about it anywhere. Suddenly you're trying to figure out what the heck happened and why didn't I have some input in this. Maybe I really like that, the park, or maybe it blocks my view or whatever it may be. And I didn't know about it because no one was there to write about it.
Right. Michael, you were saying just a moment ago that the end of 2020, you lost some key advertisers. I gather you're suggesting that the pandemic has been pretty tough on the Northeast News. Tell us a little bit more about that.
With Steve, we were having difficulties prior to the pandemic, and obviously for, you know, that 20-year freefall Justin refers to, we're victims of that. And so when the pandemic hit, we had two or three medium level advertisers pull their ads, but we got through with round one of PPP funding and a Google grant for journalism, got us through the course of the year. But when, you know, you lose, everybody knows in this business that you need big parking lots to pay the bills. And I refer to grocery stores. We had two laundromats, a charter school, and a grocery store pull their ads all at the same time, which equates to about a $2,800 a month hit. And when you've got a newsroom of four people, a staff of six, that's a pretty substantial hit to the, I mean, that's a gut punch. That's a death blow. So we, in that, I was completely transparent with everything here. And rather than bail, the staff all said, okay, let's go. It's all hands on deck. Let's make this happen. And it's really been extremely encouraging from everybody being on board for that. And the results that have come from that, we found out last week that advertiser, the grocery store, is coming back on board. We also had a banker who lives here in the community who said, well, let me try to get you round two of PPP funds through my bank. And that was successful.
Huh, so wow.
We've had some very, very positive. We've had new advertisers come on board. And so it's starting to pay off is what I'm saying. And I'm extremely happy to do that.
Wow.
Extremely happy about that.
Right. Justin, you know, sometimes you hear this idea that newspapers have done a lousy job of promoting themselves, that in some ways they've been their own worst enemies. What do you think of that idea? Is there something to it?
There could be something to that. I mean, I do think newspapers have to do a better job selling themselves and selling their product. We often, as reporters or people in the for people to subscribe out of an altruistic reason because it's the right thing to do. I think at the end of the day, you have to just give people a product that they want to buy. That's the only sustainable way to help this industry. I don't think you can sit around and wait for a billionaire to come around and save you or for people to suddenly just have some compulsion to buy a bunch of subscriptions. I mean, right. I think if people a product that means something to them and that they want to be a part of, that they buy into, and they buy a subscription. If you get enough people to do that, we can bring papers back. I mean, there's no reason that the papers of 30, 40 years ago cannot come back. They were driven by advertising, which has taken a hit, they're largely driven by community advertising, grocery stores, and whatever it may be, and by subscription.
Right.
There's no reason things can't come back.
You know, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the importance of local newspapers and the fact that 1,800 of them have closed in this country since 2004. If by chance you're up in the northeast part of Kansas City and stumbled across the Northeast News's blank front page, we'd be curious to know what your reaction was to it. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Michael, how much of this is just due to the fact that people don't sit down to read as much as they once did? Is that part of the equation here? There's been a lifestyle change in this country, and that's hurt newspapers.
I think that's a good percentage of it. A lot of people, you know, ourselves included, we're journalists. We've got to have information at our fingertips. So, you know, everybody carries around a smartphone, and that's where a good percentage of our digital audience is getting their news, at least from us. But we still have readers that I want to have that tactile experience of holding that newspaper. Mm-hmm. I want to see that. I want to feel that. So,
well, you're talking lucky to one, if that makes you feel any better, Michael. Yeah. as you might imagine. Yeah.
You're an old ink stained wretch like myself. So, but yeah, I mean, it's just an amazing transformation. And I, quite frankly, our audience on our digital platforms is almost 2.5 times or 3 times that of what our print audience is. Mm. But the fact of the matter is, the print ads are what pays the bills.
Wow.
And what pays dollars in print in advertising revenues pays pennies online. So you've really, really got to, I mean, this is a balancing act, and you, you walk a fine line every single day.
You know, Justin, you recently published a book about Floyd Bledsoe. For those who aren't familiar with the case, catch us up on what that was about, because I want to ask you about it.
Yeah, Floyd Bledsoe was framed by his brother in Oskaloosa, Kansas in 1999. He spent more than 15 years in prison for crimes he did not commit. That's sort of the shortest summary I could give. He was released at the end of 2015 when DNA results and his brother's suicide cleared him of the crime.
Well, so to what extent would your book have been possible if you didn't have the local reporting of the Oskaloosa Independent and other small local newspapers in Kansas that you relied on to get this book done?
It just would not have been nearly as good. It would not have been nearly as thorough. It compelled me to write this op-ed in the Reflector. It's just looking back at my sourcing on this book, and I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it in any serious ways without newspaper archives. The Oskaloosa Independent's a tremendous paper that does yeoman's work day in and day out and has for decades. And I relied on their archives tremendously. And not only them, but there were papers across the country that, you know, maybe they didn't cover the exact case, but they wrote about one person who then later became the coroner in Oskaloosa, or sheriff, you know, later on, and just they covered different aspects, and I had to piece all that together.
I was going to say, point to one specific story that these papers wrote that you wouldn't have been able to find anywhere else.
The prosecutor in the case had some really questionable decisions, but he misused county funds, most likely, and the Oskaloosa Independent covered that. Mostly through covering the county commission meetings. This is something that would not have fallen on the radar of the Kansas City Star or the Topeka Capital Journal,
right,
which are both just newspapers. You know, you just can't be everywhere if you're a bigger paper like that, or if you're any paper, any news outlet. And so they were covering, just didn't show up anywhere else. And even the smaller stuff like local elections or county board meetings, the police blotter. I mean, I cited the police blotter a few times. That police blotter doesn't show up anywhere else but the Oskaloosa Independent. If it's not there, I just flat out don't know these things.
Right. That's the voice of Justin Wingerder. He's a reporter for the Denver Post. He's written a book about Four Shots and Oski. That's the book we're talking about here. We're also joined today by Michael Bushnell, who's publisher of the Northeast News. Let's go to some phone calls again at 816-235-2888. Stan from Gladstone. Stan, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. I just wanted to make a comment kind of related to the last thing that was mentioned, but it's like published newspapers are pretty critical as a historical record, public record of what was said or done or what happened. And we've seen that in the last several years how social media and online information can easily be manipulated, revised, corrected, modified, and it's no longer reliable. And having that published written newspaper that you can refer to is certainly one of the major benefits of having them. That's all I had to say.
Yeah, I appreciate the phone call, Stan. And that's exactly what you're talking about, Justin. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. Stan's 100% correct. You know, I mean, I began this conversation by talking about the need to watch the government. I think that's the most important thing that we're losing, or that we run the risk of losing. But there is a secondary first draft of history that we're talking about. that is going to go away if these papers are not there to cover local elections, board meetings, you know, just even basic arrest in a criminal case. It's just the stuff that bigger papers aren't covering.
You know, Michael, there's a term for this when a newspaper goes away and what happens to a community. It's called a news desert. And even in our own neck of the woods, you could argue that Wyandotte County, Kansas, has become something of a news desert. And there's a project I'm working on at UMKC to try to address this. But it's happening right here in the metro is my point.
You're exactly right, Steve. When the Kansas City Kansan folded up, and then prior to that, I think it was the Wyandotte West Journal, which serviced the area out essentially past 75th and State out towards the fairgrounds and what's the Legends now. But there's a huge news desert there. And quite frankly, and I'm going to refer to this as mainstream media, the TV stations and the major daily, when they come in, 90% of the time, it's for a crime story. They're not there to cover, you know, the local soccer team that just made nationals, or like in our last week's paper, the iron workers that replaced a fence around the cemetery on Truman Road. They're off to the next story. And that's so important for community journalists. We are embedded in our communities, and there is a news desert in Kansas City, Kansas. And quite frankly, if the Northeast News folds up, there's going to be a huge news desert in Kansas City's urban core.
You know, Michael, to Justin's point earlier, are there stories over the years that you're particularly proud of that the Northeast News has covered that maybe highlight the need for a hyper-local news entity covering your part of Kansas City?
Absolutely. And one of the things that we tabled the week of the blank front page was there was a housing summit that was hosted by our local state representative. We had some city officials on there and neighborhood people and some people from the houseless community advocates were on there. And that we elected to hold that story because the bigger story was what happens if we're not here to cover that story. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one of the biggest stories that I've covered is the 2015 fire that on Independence Avenue, tragically, right. We lost John Mesh and Larry Leggio.
Right. Firefighters.
Mm-hmm. The firefighters, right. And I was on site inside the perimeter covering that story as it happened. And we covered that story from bumper to bumper, from that night all the way to the sentencing, and we were embedded there. And I think we were the ones really that gave some local insight to that story and the after effects and then what's going on right now at the fire site. Those are two of the biggies. And then of course the historic stuff that we do every single week with the postcard and we've kind of tabled the opinion piece from me for COVID reasons, but just those weekly stories, the chili dinners, the school board meetings, the soccer park for the kids, those are the bread and butter of community journalists, and those are the stories that matter to the community.
You know, Justin, we were talking about news deserts just a couple of minutes ago. These things aren't restricted just to the Kansas City area. They're taking place all across the country. How common are they? What are you seeing?
Yeah, more common than any of us would like, and it is very important. I like Kansas City and the work that Michael and his colleagues are doing. It's just so important. It's also really important in rural America. You're seeing a lot of areas like in Western Kansas where you have whole multiple counties without a news source. And out there, it's just so important. I mean, you know, they'll be going to be able to make it out there even less than they make it out to Oskaloosa, for example, in Northeast Kansas. It's just so crucial to have that local news source and local input. And to Michael's point, people ingrained in the community who understand the community, understand what's important to the community and the people of that community. If you're not there, you don't know. And you can't just drop in for a story like to know the whole city. So really, really important. And news deserts are a huge issue that
right.
No one has an answer for right now.
You know, Michael, we're talking about the impact on local communities. Pointer, which reports on the news industry across the country, reported a couple months ago that the pandemic had already closed more than 60 local newspapers in America. In Missouri, that includes the Bell Banner, the Blade Courier, and the Marist County Gazette. Closer to home, the Jackson County Advocate printed its last issue in December. Have you been following this, and how does it make you feel? How in danger does that make you feel as you see all this, not far from your backyard?
Well, I know the editor for the Jackson County Advocate, and we actually picked up a past managing editor here at the Northeast Newsroom Advocate, and it leaves a huge hole in that South Kansas City Grandview community. And it's you ask how I feel about that. And it's, you're kind of looking out the window. You're scared to look out the window. You're a little scared to open that door because you just never know when that's going to come creeping into your wheelhouse. And so you do your dead level best to be as relevant as you can and run that balance, that thin line financial balance that you've got to do in order to stay open. And
Michael, I just got 30 seconds here.
It's really sad.
David called in to ask, what about going nonprofit like KCUR here and get by on public support?
We're looking at that real seriously. We're actually discussing that as we speak.
All right. That's Michael Bushnell, publisher of the Northeast News. Michael, thanks for taking the time. Best of luck. We're pulling for you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Justin Wingerder also joined us, a reporter for the Denver Post. His new book, Four Shots in Oski, Murder and Innocence in Middle America. Justin, appreciate your time as well.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
That's it for today. You've been listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We'll be back tomorrow.